Well, good morning, everyone, and it's great to see everyone here so bright and early to this session, developing a fair and reasonable unit pricing restitution policy. I guess 4 or 5 years ago, there was an acceptance in industry of approximations and sort of broadness in approaches that achieved vague equity between investors in unit pricing, but that's certainly changed. And the industry has paid out tens of millions of dollars in compensation. And since the regulator has released their good practice guide, ASIC and APRA have released their good practice guide, the tolerance for errors has tightened markedly and continues. So today, it's great to have Trang and Anthony from Deloitte, and both of whom have significant experience with unit pricing programs, and particularly unit pricing restitution programs, to present their paper and extend the debate on the application of materiality in unit pricing correction programs. So presenting their paper, developing a fair and reasonable unit pricing restitution policy. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Anthony and Trang.
And welcome all. This work comes out of work that we've done for clients recently, and I've been particularly concerned that although it's quite right and appropriate in some instances to correct unit pricing errors, that in many cases we're doing a whole lot of work for very, very little benefit to the ultimate beneficiaries. So the question is what is fair and reasonable, and how should we balance the various conflicting interests? So those are our agenda. And I'll kick off with the first section, and Trang will do the next two, and I'll do the last one. So this is the trustee's responsibility, so where we start. And the trustee's responsibility is principally, what is fair? Trustees are responsible for acting fair, for treating their members in a fair way. And the issues that relate to that, reasonable expectations, materiality, and administrative contracts, are what I want to talk about first. What is fair? Now, this is the traditional model of justice, and I think it's a very helpful thing to use to show up. You've firstly got to notice that she is a woman with a scale, swathed in a whole lot of clothes. So she's opposite to a naked man. So that's an important thing to think about. Why is that the case? And the reason is, I think, in terms of just general image, is that if you put a man up there with no clothes on, he's going for something. He's an athlete. He's going to go for an objective straight away. It doesn't matter what the concerns are. I mean, in ancient terms, that's what it amounts to. The clothed woman emphasizes process. It's the process of determining what is fair that is as important, in fact, more important than the ultimate result. This has been shown. It's been known for many years. Recent research has shown that people are happy with the results of a fair process, even though they may differ from what they expect is the fairest thing for them. That it's not just a question of trading off the interests of various parties. It's the question of giving to each party the maximum that they're due and the maximum that is possible. Which is to say that when you're considering, it's important to get the process right, but it's important to make sure that you never give away anything on anyone's behalf except reluctantly. So that's part of the issue. You can't be flippant in a sense, oh, well, that's immaterial, or that's they don't count. Everyone counts. Everyone's got to be considered. Why this model is important in this instance is that you can't really go into decisions that are really rather complicated decisions about how to balance off efficiency, the costs of a particular a particular restitution, against the question of just deserts, who actually deserves to get more. You can't just balance it off. You've got to think a little bit about how you can optimize it, perhaps by getting the money from somewhere else. Well, not perhaps. That's a big issue about getting money from somewhere else. So those are the criteria. Just deserts, meaning you give people what they deserve, both rewards and punishments. Liberty, you try not to interfere in people's lives in any way by sending them letters with checks for sent. Equality, you treat people as equally as possible. And there are two types of equality, well, a number of types of equality. There's equality of input, equality of output. There's vertical equality and horizontal equality. Horizontal equality means that if people are the same, you must treat them the same. Vertical equality, which is quite useful in this case, means that if they're different, you should the difference in treatment must be proportional to their difference. So someone who's been around a year should be treated very similarly to someone who's been around a year and a day. They're not really different. You can consider need, give away to charity, perhaps, as some companies have done. And you certainly must consider efficiency, and you might want to consider status, although I don't think that's particularly important in these criteria. So trustees should go through a process. If they've gone through a process, no court, and exercise this carefully, no court or regulator ought to be able to overturn them. And that was one of if you read the AAT's ruling on the AXA super case where they overturned APRA's banning of the AXA trustees, they were very clear to say, look, we do not have the power to overturn a considered decision. And if you followed a considered process, no regulator or court acting properly will overturn your position. Trustees' responsibilities to be reasonable expectations. The reasonable expectations are part of the legal framework and are likely to be included in the decision-making process. What's important is of this, and I've got this whole lot out here, reasonable expectations is not created by industry practice, whatever that means. And that's why I've been a bit concerned by people saying, well, what's industry practice? We've got to do what the industry's got to do. That's a really bad start. It's easily answered by, as I said, it's told a million times around the world every day. But, Mummy, everybody's doing it. Yes, but, dear, it doesn't make it right. So the question is, it's legislation, the governing rules, what we've said, what we've done, and eventually what other people are doing. That is, it can be a guide if nothing else is around, but it's really right at the end of the creation of reasonable expectations. Just a comment on materiality. The slide is important. If you've got a lawyer that says materiality doesn't apply in superannuation, if that is an opinion that is held by some lawyers, it's not held universally. Certainly APRA has said, this is a quote from David Rush, the level of materiality to apply in a particular case is not therefore decided by the regulators. It can be decided, and one can operate on the basis of immateriality. And it's just the Latin concept, de minimis, the law is not concerned itself with trifles, is right. Anyone went to court to sue you for 5 cents, they would be thrown out before. Well, they would never get there. It's not a legal issue. This slide is important, administrative contracts, because some lawyers have tended to say, well, you've got a contract with your administrator, whether an internal in the same group or an external administrator, and you have the legal responsibility to pursue the administrator for any errors that they have made to compensate the members, your members. And that's the trustee's legal responsibility in terms of pursuing other parties for the interests of the members. Yes, true, but not if to gain a short-run benefit at the expense of long-term relationships. The administrators will charge for anything in the long run. So if you're going to fight your administrator for 3 years of fees, you can be sure they're going to have to increase their fees by 300% or a percentage at some stage. It's not to the advantage of the members to have long-term fights with the administrators and administrators tipping in many, many, many millions of dollars in wasted administration in order to repay people fairly small amounts of money. Now I'll hand over to Trang on some discussion of the nature of material of unit pricing.
Hello. I just wanted to possibly rush through the nature of unit pricing just to ensure we have lots of discussion time at the end. So on the nature of unit pricing, it's widely accepted that there are various approximations and estimates in unit pricing and that it's necessary in an environment where hundreds and hundreds of unit prices are actually struck daily. Now, it's acceptable practice as long as the judgments and the estimates have been based on sound policies, they've been applied consistently, there are controls in place to monitor their appropriateness, and that they have been communicated adequately to investors or consumers. Now, ASIC and APRA, their unit pricing guide in 2005 differentiates errors from cases where sound policies have been applied consistently or are reviewed based on reasonable principles from time to time. In the latter case, it's not an error. So here we've got some common causes of errors. I think you'd be quite familiar with some of those causes. So I'll just leave it up there for a few seconds, and I'll go to the next slide. The second thing we wanted to cover was the regulatory and industry guidance around unit pricing, and in particular on compensation for errors. First ones I mentioned before, ASIC and APRA unit pricing guide, which was published in November 2005, it applies to life insurers, superannuation and the funds management industry. Now, it's expected from the guidance that the product providers will actually follow the good practice in this guide. It recognises that product providers may have reasonable and well-documented alternative practice in place. That's an actual quote from the guide. So in the context of errors and the application of materiality for the compensation of those errors, the guide has the following extracts, which are relevant. It says, in reporting to the regulators, the product provider must provide the basis for determining the compensation, and they must provide the basis for deciding the amounts of compensation to be paid and who will receive it. The guide also states that it may be relevant to consider the degree of precision that can be used in calculating the unit price. So we'll come back to that in a later slide. But as a general rule, the guidance states that if the error is greater than 30 basis points, then compensation must be paid. And if it's less than 30 basis points, then you need to assess whether compensation should be paid, taking into account two things. One, the type of asset being involved, and it talks about maybe a lower threshold might apply for a cash fund. It doesn't say what it is, just says a lower threshold. And the second thing it says you should take into account is whether the error related to the incorrect pricing of fees, in which case the regulator took the stance that it must be compensated in all cases. Now, we suggest that as long as shareholders do not actually benefit from the error, then a materiality threshold could reasonably be applied. So industry guidance is given in the IFSA standard, number 17, on correction and compensation. Now, IFSA standards, as you know, is mandatory for all members. It talks about the fact that there is no pricing issue as long as sound policy, approximations and estimates, and that a reasonable attempt has been made to estimate the impact on unit prices from any known or unknown events. It says that the scheme operator may choose a materiality threshold, but that this must not exceed 30 basis points. So it brings up the 30 basis points again. And it also talks about taking into account the type of assets involved, in which case it actually says that a threshold of 5 basis points, for example, might be more appropriate for a cash fund. It says you should not, or the scheme should not, retain any financial benefit from an error. And again, it talks about the incorrect charging of fees. It also expands on this last point here. It says, in setting the minimum dollar compensation amounts, it basically firmly states that the maximum amount of such a threshold is $20. So that comes through in that standard. So we just wanted to share with everybody some industry case studies that we've seen from just from our experience out there. We've seen a number of ways in which materiality has been applied in the case of unit pricing restitutions. For example, dollar levels, some institutions, I think Anthony mentioned earlier, have issued checks for as little as a cent, and it goes all the way up to $5. Others have ignored amounts ranging up to $5, $10, $20. And these amounts have been paid to the fund and in some cases paid to a specified charity. And this is what we've seen in the industry. Non-IFSA members have applied levels right up to $100. So that's quite a high limit there. In terms of basis points levels, we've seen materiality thresholds of 5 basis points for cash funds and 20 basis points, 30 basis points for a single event. And for recurring losses, we've seen cases of 10 basis points per annum as a materiality threshold and also 30 basis points per annum. So there's, you know, wide practice there that you're seeing. Also, if you're not already aware, a number of institutions have begun to put in wording in their product disclosure statements around how they will handle errors in the case where it does occur. And you can see from these three examples we've picked up here that it's obviously largely driven by industry and regulatory guidance. So you see the 30 basis points, the $20, the $5, et cetera, appearing. And that pretty much, you know, putting the wording in PDSs obviously will set the reasonable expectations of your consumers. Okay, in this slide, we just wanted to show that we've used a unit pricing analysis tool. It's called ADAP. It was actually developed by Anthony when he was at APRA. But basically, it can produce graphs of unit pricing movements just based on published unit prices. And these actually allow us to identify errors, and they also show that errors are frequently minute when compared to the daily average movements in unit prices. So in the third graph there, you probably can't see it, but it says residual of daily differences. You can see the outliers there. It could actually mean the outliers are potential errors of up to 100 basis points there, and that can be dwarfed by, in the first graph and the second graph, the normal daily volatility in the unit prices, as well as the price movements over a particular year. So that just gives you some context for errors. So from various simple analysis we've done in a paper, we suggest that a level materiality of a fund could reasonably be based on the average daily movements in the unit prices, just as part of the consideration on materiality. Okay, in this next section, I'm going to run through the various criteria a trustee, what we suggest a trustee should consider in coming up with or in exercising their discretion, determining what members' reasonable expectations might be. The first thing is the process. I think Anthony mentioned this with the picture earlier, but basically there's two questions. Is there discretion, and are the judges disinterested? Is there discretion? It means that in practice, trustees are often required to exercise discretion, and this is because contracts are seldom explicit, but rather trustees do actually have to rely on reasonable expectations of their members. So are the judges disinterested? What this means is that the people making the decision on the restitution need to be free of conflicts of interest. An important consequence of this is that the product provider should never benefit from the losses to affected investors when errors are identified. So determining reasonable expectations. Now, if the unit pricing or error correction methodology is not contractual, then the trustee needs to determine the investor's reasonable expectations. And we put here three categories as examples. These might be set by industry standards, which we just talked about, past internal practice, and also general accounting standards. If I can just give you some examples on the industry standards topic. Now, in the event that nothing has been said, then investors could reasonably expect that you would follow industry and regulatory guidance. Now, if the practices of other funds are well known, however, then that too can create expectations in investors' minds. So one implication for product providers and the industry more widely is that when adopting a particular policy for materiality or what is actually paid, then that will actually set a precedent for future practices. Now, under general accounting standards, we put the example there that general accounting standards says makes a statement about materiality, and it talks about 5% of balance sheet items or 5% of profit items. So in the context of errors, we compare that against investment returns, net of fees and taxes. And if you place 5% on that over any reasonable period of time, you're talking about a level of materiality under general accounting standards of somewhere between 15 basis points and 45 basis points. So that just helps you give some framework around the concept of materiality. Now, determining materiality, I guess it was in the picture of justice, but what I wanted to cover in detail was the criteria of efficiency, just deserts, and equality. So the first one's efficiency. What does that mean? We make the statement here that it appears inefficient for investors to be compensated unless the compensation is significantly greater than the volatility of the fund between times when prices are set. This could be daily or weekly. The measurement errors that occur over the relevant period, the cost of remediation, and the fourth point, the costs that the members themselves incur to process that information. The last point is we believe it would also be inefficient to incur more costs in recovering amounts from members who have actually benefited from the error than the amount of compensation themselves. So that covers the point of efficiency there. We just wanted to show you some examples on the volatility in fund prices and cost of remediation and so on. So here, in this slide, we want to talk about the indicative volatility or average daily movements in unit prices. Now, in the normal course of events, you agree that investors do not make buy and sell decisions. I should say investors make buy and sell decisions over periods of days and weeks, not overnight. So daily fluctuations in this table show that it can range from 2 basis points, unit prices, normal daily fluctuations for cash funds, up to 100 basis points for some international share funds. Now, this level of volatility, we suggest, is actually an acceptable part of investing in the market. So in the context of materiality, we argue that this gives an order of magnitude below which operating decisions around refinements in unit pricing becomes spurious accuracy. Now, because of the inherent approximations within the unit pricing process, we believe a level of tolerance should be seen as reasonable in the instance when an error is identified. Here, one of the key areas where estimates are applied are in the allocation of tax. So this table here shows how tax accrual estimates can differ depending on the formula and the assumptions that we use. We compare here the simple approach, which is basically a percentage, 5% or 10%, for tax accrual estimates of the investment returns. And that gives various tax accrual estimates there, depending on the investment returns, against a more accurate approach. And in this case, we've taken explicit assumptions of interest, dividends, expenses, and imputation credits, and that gives you the last two columns. So when you compare the numbers across the various columns, you can see, you know, the estimates can vary widely. And this is normal day-to-day operations. Of course, you correct it once, you know, your tax is known in actuality, but this is normal. way, determining materiality, the criteria, the other criteria we talked about was the cost of remediation. What have we actually seen out there? Now, there's two elements to this issue. One is the overhead cost of the remediation process, and this includes things like management distraction from the day-to-day operations of your business, the cost of determining methodology, calculating, implementing it, cost of tracking exited investors, setting up call centres to answer queries, and of course the cost of advisors. So we've seen overhead costs easily of the order of magnitude of the amounts being remediated. And in some cases, we've seen the cost of remediation being up to 10 times the amounts being remediated. Now, even for relatively simple errors, it's not out of the question to see that the cost of remediation of setting up the process and so on being greater than $1 million, and that's just for a small superannuation fund. And on top of the overhead costs, you've got marginal costs on a per-member basis. And these numbers aren't out of the question. We consider something like $20 for out-of-force members, and that's tracking them, correspondences, sending checks to them, and $5 for in-force members. That's not out of the question, and that's for correcting member balances, sending out correspondences. So these are huge costs of remediation we're talking about here, which often companies and the industry incur without any reference to, you know, a materiality policy. The last point is we should raise is the longer term costs in higher administration charges, which will eventually flow back. So when people go through a restitution exercise, they tend to look at the short term costs and don't consider the sort of longer term flow back costs to investors. Under the cost to investors to actually process the information, here we're talking about the administrative burden from reading correspondences, banking, tax returns and so on associated with the errors. Now our paper sort of works through these examples, and again with these sort of numbers, we don't think it's unreasonable to actually place these numbers up here. We're talking about $5 opportunity costs, for example, to a member from reading the literature, somewhere between $5 and $20 for receiving the checks and actually banking the checks in terms of opportunity costs, somewhere around $50 where another super fund is being credited in terms of eventual flowback costs to the members, and something like $500 or more when the receiving fund actually has to perform its own remediation exercise. Now, in some instances, trustees may only be able to recoup compensation arising from the errors from the members themselves, or they may have a reserve set up for the benefit of all members. Now, it can be extremely expensive to recover amounts overpaid to exited investors, and recovering monies from current investors will likely give rise to loss of business, complaints, and perhaps even litigation. So in this sort of situation, we suggest that it's appropriate to apply much higher levels of materiality where recoverability is sought. And we would expect trustees to balance the probable amounts that could be recovered against the probable cost of collection, litigation, as well as adverse publicity. So high level of materiality is there than would otherwise apply. So I just covered under determining materiality the criteria around efficiency. The other ones I want to talk about, the second one, just deserts. Again, basically just means investors deserve to get what they earned. So in making restitution for unit price errors, a distinction should be made between those made in error and those that resulted from intention. So this suggests to us a different treatment for arbitrage errors. And we argue that a much lower level of materiality would apply in correcting for arbitrage errors. Under equality, I wanted to cover three particular topics. The first one is systematic biases. Now, that means that some classes of members are consistently better off than others as part of the unit pricing process. And we suggest that as long as these are based on reasonable estimates and policies at the time, then the compensation for such biases, the trustees might apply a greater level of materiality and place greater consideration on the cost of remediation than would apply for something like arbitrage errors. Random errors will mean that all members have an equal chance of winning and losing. So in this case, if an error occurred as a result of random errors, for example, even greater materiality limits would appear to apply with consideration given to the size of the other random risks that members are exposed to. So dollar materiality, now this is an interesting one because the ASIC and APRA guide, they raise the objection that dollar materiality levels could be seen to discriminate against low-income people. So we say that while this is probably true, we believe it's unlikely to apply at the $20 level that IFSA has set in the guide. And our paper expands on this with some examples, but essentially we give examples around the context of an Australian earning minimum wages. I won't go through the numbers because I'm not very good with mental arithmetic, so but it's in our paper. But we do suggest the $20 is on the low side. Okay, applying materiality, Anthony will close off with this plus discussion.
Another story about actuaries and mental arithmetic. There are three types of actuaries, those that can count and those that can't. And anyway, right. So we end our paper with suggesting, okay, well, now, if they're the principles, how would we go about a pragmatic approach? Firstly, if we assume that that we were not bound by the IFSA standard, which is a binding agreement between its members, firstly, very important to consider that the major principles are not infringed. The manager, the shareholders are not benefiting from the fee errors, and that there be no arbitrage or unfair biases in prices, because if there has been arbitrage and some members have benefited at the cost of others, that's really a fairness issue that we need to consider particularly carefully. Then we say, well, what about a trigger point? And where is the number we've come up with is that the cumulative impact of the error is more than the mean absolute deviation, the average daily price movement in the fund, which could be up to 100 basis points for volatile equity funds. We come to that number partly because, well, one is a very nice round number, sort of has an intrinsic sort of sense to it. But secondly, using the ADAP tool in attempting to identify errors, we've come up with the fairly reasonable rule of thumb that we don't suggest that funds investigate errors in excess of under 2.5 standard deviations from our normal error. So ADAP produces an estimate of the unit prices and an error. Looking over a year, we would say, well, if the blip that we saw on that graph was more than 2.5 standard deviations, we would find it worthwhile investigating. And our part one error experiences that more than half of those errors, of those anomalies, will actually turn out to be errors of some sort or another. So at that point, we think they're worth investigating. Under that point, we don't think they're worth investigating. If they're not worth investigating as errors, why bother? And that actually happens to be, for, depending on the nature of the fund, about equal to the average daily movement. So basically saying the average daily movement, we will say, doesn't look as though we're sure we're not making profit from the fees, we're sure there's no arbitrage, we're happy with the, we're not going to investigate this blip, this anomaly in share prices, it's just not worth it. Once you've identified it, it seems, because a good deal of the costs actually are involved in the investigation, there does seem some sense in saying, well, okay, we've investigated, we've now found an error, and then use a materiality level for the actual restitution of perhaps half of the trigger value or 30 basis points if you want, but half the trigger value sounded a reasonable number. And then based on the numbers that Trang spoke about earlier, about $10, use materiality level, perhaps $10 for existing members, where you can just put the money into their fund and tell them at the end of the year in the annual accounts in a sentence that they got, you made the error and you fixed it. And perhaps $100 for exits. It may sound a little extreme, but really, we find for the $20, I think the average industry experience is that less than half of the people are actually cashing it. I mean, I find it an insult. I've got to think about it. I really do not want to think about whether I should cash this $15 check or not. it's too hard. So that's what our suggestion is. Now, obviously, we're not there. And the question arose in our discussion with some of the legal players in the industry is whether we can't actually move, if so, in that direction. And we actually are hoping that this particular paper will encourage the industry to think again about restitution and find ways of cutting the costs of making errors, which are just unavoidable. So our final summary is... we are convinced that trustees are being fair when they go through a fair process and disclose a reasonable error rectification methodology to keep the costs down. And secondly, that a more robust approach to materiality than we currently use in general would better serve the industry and reduce our level of stress. But it really would be better for the industry. So the question is where to from here? Well, this is the first step. What is the response from the profession? What is the response? We'll be circulating to a few lawyers and hopefully passing it on to the IFSA committee that deals with these things. So we're now open to discussion.
Thanks. Thanks, Anthony. So that's right. We'll just throw it open to Bruce. We'll throw it open to questions. So, Bruce. Bruce, there isn't. So if you wouldn't mind going to the... Sorry, if you've got any questions, if you wouldn't mind coming to the front and using the microphones. Thanks.
Bruce Vincent. Anthony, that was my question. Where to from here? And another question was, can we start tomorrow? But that's a more personal question. You mentioned IFSA. I think it all, in the end, starts and ends with trustees. And whilst in a life company environment, there's ordinary policies and deferred annuities and external trustee products that are sold, it does come down to the trustees. And I wonder, in some situations, there's trustees who are hiding behind the contract with the life company, where the primary relationship with the members is with the life company. Most members perhaps wouldn't be aware of the existence of the trustee. So are trustees, in fact, making decisions? Are they hiding behind a contract? Is it a case of the deep pocket syndrome that someone's going to pay? I think we should explore, we should understand that, because if it was just the trustee themselves, would they be making certain of the decisions that seem to get made? Next point was about independence, and in the end, none of us are totally independent. Certainly in restitution programs, there's vast groups of contractors and other people, there's advisors, there's in fact multiple sets of advisors, so and there's lots of fees, and I think that's already been spoken of, the costs just many multiples of what actually gets returned to members, and then as Anthony says, half of them don't want it anyway for small amounts. So I think there's a real education role here for the profession, the legal people, to actually educate trustees to understand how to actually make decisions rather than not make decisions, because I think there's been a lot of non-decision making. In terms of cost to members, we've got a little bit of experience of cost to members. We've done a little bit of research, and it's true that members, there's more than just financial considerations. People's utility, time, inconvenience must be factored in. Yet I think many times people talk about costs, benefits in terms of dollars, when most people it's more the inconvenience. And so I think the paper does mention a number of situations there, particularly dealing with the issue of paying restitution to deceased estates. It's a very, very, very difficult situation, and so one needs to think very carefully as to what's in the best interest of investors there. Another situation would be where there's investment product via a life company to external trustees that to pay small amounts of money, perhaps even the thousands, could give rise to many layers of costs in the receiving fund. So there's it's a very much having to think of each particular circumstance and what is, in the end, in the best interest of the ultimate members and investors as opposed to perhaps the players, because we all get caught up with the game. So education of trustees is very important. So I've mentioned research, and so just to reiterate some of the points that Anthony made, that small amounts of restitution are derived from small account balances, and I think the paper says that, and many small account balances are in respect of lost members, and so there can be a massive process of trying to communicate with people who are lost in the first place. If you're rolling over small amounts on behalf of people, that can irritate them as well, in that they can't get their hands on the money. So I think there's a growing amount of research, and some of it's anecdotal, but it's certainly if one reads transcripts of call centre questions and answers, the ones that they don't actually censor, or you read what's written on forms that get sent back when you send out, and so we can't give you the money, you've got to actually fill out this form and send it back to us. So you get a pretty good idea of what people think.
Okay, Bruce.
I think that's probably enough. Sorry.
Okay. Were there any quick final observations, Bruce, you wanted to make?
I think it's just the education. It does start from here, and let's start tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks, Bruce. Did anyone else have any observations or questions?
Thanks. I'm Margaret Bishop from BNP Paribas. I'm probably one of the only custodian representatives here. And while I'm not an expert in unit pricing, there are a couple of things I would like to note. Having tried myself to work out why we make so many unit pricing errors when unit pricing is simply value of assets divided by the number of units on issue. But I think in terms of determining materiality and that sort of thing, it is important to note that in this country we have a great range of unit pricing methodologies out there. The way fees are applied, the types of fees that apply, whether they apply to net asset values or gross asset values and that sort of thing. We have multi-class structures now where different investors might pay different fee levels. We have performance fees, which require people to perhaps monitor at an individual unit holder level whether they have a credit or a debit against their balance. And all these things make it very difficult for whoever is calculating the unit price to do this in an automated way. So I think from that perspective, all of that flexibility and variety is great for our products, but it does lead to greater errors. And if you take that in conjunction with the good practice pricing guides, they are very much good practice. They're not at all prescriptive. And so I would say those things taken together do lead to more errors. And we need to bear that in mind as well when we're determining what materiality is. Because if we were in an environment where things were more standard, it might be more possible to limit those errors. I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Margaret. Wade?
Hi, Wade Tubman from PwC. Thanks for the paper. I've just got a few comments on materiality. I'm part of the IFSA working group on unit pricing, and IFSA is very interested, obviously, in materiality. As you might be aware, there's a big discrepancy or divergence between what ASIC and APRA have said and what IFSA says, and that's something that is obviously causes a lot of concern. From our experience, companies have tended to follow the IFSA approach until the regulator gets involved, and then all sorts of problems generally arise. One thing that we've been made aware of recently, which is quite interesting, is that ASIC are actually, in particular, are looking at this again. And at a recent conference, Carol Ferguson actually made an announcement that they're going to be looking at a dollar materiality threshold. So we're expecting something to come out in the next few months on that. From my understanding, it's actually back in APRA's court at the moment. It's been sort of flipping between the two, but we are expecting some sort of announcement on a dollar materiality limit. And that's been the real issue. Both the ASIC APRA guide and IFSA standards seem to talk about the basis point materiality, and I think that's generally accepted. It's the dollar materiality limit that seems to be causing the biggest problem, and also the biggest embarrassments when you're sending 1 cent checks to people. One other comment on the materiality limit. It often gets put back to us about how we can, you know, sort of cut it off at an arbitrary level, and how, you know, if you're sending out checks to some people, how you can't send it out to others. In talking about the pragmatism, one important thing to think about is when you've got collapses such as ACR and Bridgecorp and things like that, where, you know, people have lost their life savings under the same regulator, and then they receive a 5 cent check for some unit pricing error. It just puts it all in perspective. And one issue that we think could happen is if something like that happens to Alan Jones, if he gets a 5 cent check, or one of the guys from the Chasers War, it'll just be very embarrassing for the whole industry. So that hasn't happened yet, and hopefully that embarrassment doesn't happen. One other final point is there's massive variance in practice across the industry. All the things you've talked about here are things that are being considered by all the large players, but I've also had a bunch of experiences with some of the smaller players, and I think you talked about some of the approaches up to $100 and things like that. Even in the terms of recognition of an error, some of the smaller players will just, you know, just deny an error has ever occurred, even if it's blatantly obvious. So we've got to be careful about applying these sort of things, because, you know, you can really punish the good, and where people and some of these organisations who just, you know, maybe don't have as much regard for their customers and the standards are getting away with a lot. But thanks a lot for the paper. It's very good.
Okay. Thanks, Wade. Are there any more?
Sorry. Dave Morris. I think wearing my independent director's hat for a life company. Thank you very much for this paper. It's really good, and my plea really is that we do get an agreed process, and as the previous speaker said, I think it's important not only that it's IFSA, you need to get ASIC and APRA on board. The proposals that are made seem to me to be eminently sensible. I have a few concerns about that big discrepancy between in-force and exited members in terms of sort of dollar amounts, although I understand the reason for it, but in terms of fairness. But one of the problems that independent directors have is that is you're caught between ASIC and APRA, and the trustees have also got their own independent advice, which inevitably differs from the advice you're given by your own management. And this is actually a very technical area, and I don't think that the trustees and non-actuaries who are independent directors really understand how approximate the unit pricing is, because as the previous speaker says, I mean, it's dead simple. It's just the value of the assets, which... And you know, divide by the number of units. How hard can that be? Obviously very hard, because I think just about every office is probably in the process of restitution. Anyway, so I would support an agreed approach, providing APRA and ASIC come along.
Margaret Gardner Tower, and we're one of the people that seems to spend our lives doing some form of restitution, even when it's down to really quite minuscule amounts. And our difficulty has in general been ASIC. ASIC says we have to remediate 1 cent. Last time we actually wrote out to people and asked them to come back to us if they wanted their 1 cent. In fact, I think we heard from 5 out of several hundred people which isn't a big percentage. The other difficulty is actually passing. It's relatively easy to recompense everybody who are in force for even very small amounts, and it probably, I think, is very... There's not a great deal of cost to doing it. I mean, you can have your massive spreadsheets, and whether you do it for 100 or 300, it doesn't really matter. When it comes to out of force, one of the other problems is the receiving fund will not accept small amounts. So you're then in a bind that it has to be IRFed, and so the opportunity costs go up enormously, because how many people know there's money sitting in all these, you know, places around Australia where we've sent money that has come from these sorts of errors? So I'd love a sensible approach to be adopted.
Okay, thanks, Margaret. Does anyone have any other just quick, probably time for just one more quick question? No? Okay. Anthony, would you like to respond to some of those points?
Thanks very much. It's very nice to have been able to effectively give voice to what your opinions are in most instances. So I think that's it. It's certainly been encouraging. We have spoken to APRA. We will talk to Carol Wade. Sorry, her surname?
Ferguson.
We will talk to Carol Ferguson and ASIC and try and push them on. I think I agree absolutely with what everyone is saying, that we've got ourselves into a bind, the trustees, the directors, and the administrators, and we're just hoping to find a way to at least expand the area of reasonableness in these circumstances. So thank you very much for your support.
Okay, thanks, Anthony. Look, thanks to the audience for your participation. I think that was a great session. Obviously, it's a complex area. The regulators are everyone expecting people to get better at these things and use technology and try and reduce errors. I guess there's some arguments here as to why the materiality threshold needs to be re-looked at. So would you please join me in thanking Trang and Anthony for their presentations.